From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tonight, we're all in for a special treat. Jack Beatty is in the house, but not in his regular role as On Point news analyst. This hour, he's in the guest chair. If you're a regular listener to this show, you know Jack is a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. What you may not know is that he is also a prolific and well-respected writer. His 2001 anthology, Colossus, How the Corporation Changed America, was named one of the 10 best business books of the year. He's written compelling books on Peter Drucker, the management guru, and on Boston Mayor James Michael Curley in his terrific book, The Rascal King. Now, Brother Jack has turned his mighty pen to a subject near and dear to his heart, the soul of American politics. He's put together an anthology of great writing on great American political figures, Philip Roth on Richard Nixon, Norman Mailer on JFK, Hodding Carter on Huey Long, and much more. Tonight on Point, our own Jack of all trades, Jack Beatty, on the best political writing on our most memorable politicians, the voices that have shaped American political culture. The new book is Paul's Great Writers on American Politicians from Bryan to Reagan, The Boodlers, Demagogues, Heroes, Jokesters, Populists, and Thinkers. Jack Beatty joins me from his mountaintop lair in Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, it's wonderful to have you with your own offering at the table this time. Just terrific.
Well, it's a great treat, and I'm very, very grateful for you for doing the program.
Well, it's a pleasure, and I should say, first of all, on this holiday weekend, happy Thanksgiving to you up there in
New Hampshire. To you and to our listeners.
It's a great time to savor. And speaking of savoring, I savored this book front to back. You've put together such a collection here. I mean, some of it amazing writing, some of it just a description of amazing moments. The moment where, and it goes much further back in history than this, but the moment where Lee Atwater sends the young researcher, Jim Pinkerton, to go off and find the ugly little bullets that will bring down Mike Dukakis, the kind of poison pills. He gives him a 3x5 card, and as Richard Ben Kramer writes it up, he says, "You get me the stuff to beat this little bastard. I want you to put it on this card." And the card was 3x5, and Atwater says, "Use both sides." I love that. And, of course, he came up with Willie Horton and all the rest, but that's just one little moment in this great anthology. Give us a description or a feeling, Jack, for the breadth of what you've pulled together in this book.
Well, I tried to have all the archetypes here represented, you know, the southern demagogue, the northern urban boss, the crook, the charismatic hero. And I tried to match them, I hope deliciously, with writers. So I've got John Dos Passos' prose poem on Teddy Roosevelt.
That's terrific.
H.L. Mencken's lampoon of Warren Harding's prose style. Richard Hofstadter's intellectual portrait of Herbert Hoover. Arthur Schlesinger's revision of Eisenhower revisionism. Norman Mailer's depiction of John F. Kennedy coming to the convention that nominated him at Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And, of course, Philip Roth's coruscating satire on Richard Nixon. So I tried to represent the kinds of politicians and the genres of political writing.
And what's your sense, looking at all this writing, Jack, and pulling it together this way? And many of these, many of our listeners will have read over the years in one form or another, but what is it that makes the best political writing?
Well, I think the short answer is I don't know. My sense is that it's the two A's, affection or animosity.
Mm-hmm.
I write in love, I write in hate or in anger.
Right.
And those two things seem to do it. In other words, people have a reason, not just that the book contract says you got to write this book.
Yeah.
They're motivated by something. And they want to put it in there. And I think that's what marks out the really outstanding political writing. And it may be why it's hard to find it from journalists, since they can't really show too much of that. You know, they can't show too much of their affection. They certainly can't show too much of their animosity. So I found it more from writers and historians.
And that animosity or affection somehow it colors it, but it also makes it more durable, more lasting.
Well, yes. I mean, it charges the prose and also the perception. I mean, people, you know, everything matters to the writer, and they want to get it right and get their subject right. So, the intensity of their feeling, I think, in a way, is what guarantees that the things last.
Now, all these writers have taken on huge subjects. The first one you go back to was around the turn of the last century with William Jennings Bryan. And I have to say this is kind of a unique one in the book because it's a straight-up poem by Vachel Lindsay. Set the stage for this quite amazing piece, Jennings.
Well, this is an epic poem on the campaign of 1896. That pitted William Jennings Bryan, a 36-year-old Nebraska congressman, against William McKinley, the former governor of Ohio. And really, it pitted the West against the East, the farmer against the industrialist. The poor farmer had been losing ground ever since the Civil War. Indeed, farm incomes were lower in 1900 on average than in 1860. And Bryan was the voice of this discontent, the populist, the Democrat. And the poem is called Bryan, 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 Bryan.
Written on the occasion of him visiting Springfield, Illinois. And I must say, we Illinoisans have to claim William Jennings Bryan as originally from Illinois, though of course he migrated to Nebraska.
That's right. That's right. And the subtitle is The Campaign of 1896 as Viewed at the Time by a 16-year-old, etc.
And that was, of course, Vachel Lindsay himself in Springfield, Illinois in 1896.
Yes.
Just to set the picture, here's William Jennings Bryan. He's running for president. He's been campaigning all over the place. He put in 18,000 miles, we're told, sometimes giving 36 speeches a day. Huge crowds in Louisville and Columbus and Toledo. And here he was, 1896, in Springfield, Illinois. We're going to be reading a lot in this hour because there's some terrific, terrific writing here. And Jack, you've got this one right up front because it just sets that big American feeling. You read some, I'll read some, and happy holidays. Here we go.
Okay. In a nation of 100 fine, mob-hearted, lynching, relenting, repenting millions, there are plenty of sweeping, swinging, stinging, gorgeous things to shout about and knock your old blue devils out. I brag and chant of Bryan, 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 candidate for president who sketched a silver Zion, the one American poet who could sing outdoors. He brought in tides of wonder, of unprecedented splendor, wild roses from the plains that made hearts tender, all the funny circus silks of politics unfurled, Bartlett pears of romance that were honey at the cores, and torchlights down the street to the end of the world.
When Bryan came to Springfield and Altgeld gave him greeting, Rochester was deserted, Divernon was deserted, Mechanicsburg, Riverton, Chicken Bristle, Cotton Hill, empty, for all Sangamon drove to the meeting in silver-decked racing cart, buggy, buckboard, carryall, carriage, phaeton, whatever would haul, and silver-decked farm wagons gritted, banged, and rolled with the new tale of Bryan by the old iron tires told. The state house loomed afar, a speck, a hive, a football, a captive balloon, and the town was all one spreading wing of bunting, plumes, and sunshine, every rag and flag and Bryan picture sold when the rigs in many a dusty line jammed our streets at noon and joined the wild parade against the power of gold. I stood by my best girl. She was a cool young citizen with wise and laughing eyes. With my necktie by my ear, I was stepping on my dear. But she kept like a pattern, without a shaken curl. She wore in her hair a brave prairie rose. Her gold chums cut her, for that was not the pose. No Gibson girl would wear it in that fresh way. But we were fairy Democrats, and this was our day.
Election night at midnight. Boy, Bryan's defeat. Defeat of Western silver. Defeat of the wheat. Victory of letter files and plutocrats in miles with dollar signs upon their coats, diamond watch chains on their vests, and spats on their feet. Victory of custodians, Plymouth Rock, and all that inbred landlord stock. Victory of the neat, defeat of the aspen groves of Colorado valleys, the blue bells of the Rockies and blue bonnets of old Texas by the Pittsburgh alleys. Defeat of alfalfa and the Mariposa lily, defeat of the Pacific and the long Mississippi, defeat of the young by the old and silly, defeat of tornadoes by the poison vat supreme, defeat of my boyhood, defeat of my dream.
Vachel Lindsay's Bryan, 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 Bryan. And, of course, Bryan, as indicated there, goes down in defeat. And I have to say, Jack, by this point, the world is my home. But as an Illinois farm boy, born and bred, this really speaks to me. It really speaks to me. The joy in it, the passion in it. I mean, this is not that dry column that says analysis on page one. This is the guts of the matter.
And it accurately reflected the passion that Brian incited. Partly it was because of his voice. He could speak and be heard by audiences as large as 30,000, which seems unbelievable.
It does seem unbelievable. And you've cited many times this election where he was up against McKinley as a pivotal moment in American political history.
Well, it was. I mean, it represented sort of the defeat of the agrarian civilization of America. I mean, it had been losing ground, and finally it was defeated by industrial America. And the Republicans really set up a political hegemony that lasted for decades. And, of course, Paul Rove is a student of this campaign of 1896, and he sees himself as the new Mark Hanna, who was the political
puppeteer.
Boss, who set this going and who pushed McKinley out there, and some people even think that campaign might have a lot to say to us today, since it seemed to divide the nation along red and blue lines. Only in those days, the red was the Democrat.
Yeah, it sure was. Let's keep diving ahead here. There's such delicious stuff. You've got a piece by Harding Carter on Huey Long, of course, Kingfish, the great Louisiana politician. And you jump into it with some observations of your own. I wish you'd share those with us, Jack.
Well, I've got a first paragraph that I stick ahead of Harding's piece from a T. Harry Williams' biography of Huey Long, which won the Pulitzer Prize. And I think when people hear the first paragraph, they'll understand why. If I may, I'll read it.
Please.
The story seems too good to be true, but people who should know swear that it is true. The first time that Huey P. Long campaigned in rural, Latin, Catholic South Louisiana, the local boss who had him in charge said at the beginning of the tour, "Huey, you ought to remember the one thing in your speeches today. You're from North Louisiana, but now you're in South Louisiana, and we've got a lot of Catholic voters down here." "I know," Long answered. And throughout the day, in every small town, Long would begin by saying, "When I was a boy, I would get up at 6 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, and I would hitch up our old horse to the buggy, and I would take my Catholic grandparents to Mass. I'd bring them home, and at 10 o'clock I'd hitch up the old horse again, and I'd take my Baptist grandparents to church." The effect of the anecdote on the audiences was obvious, and on the way back to Baton Rouge that night, the local leader said admiringly, "Why, Huey, you've been holding out on us. I didn't know you had any Catholic grandparents." "Don't be a damn fool," replied Long. "We didn't even have a horse."
And here it is, and it's right in your subtitle, Jack. I mean, you say, the boodlers, demagogues, heroes, jokesters, populists, and thinkers. Which do we have here in Huey Long? Boodler, jokester, certainly populist.
We certainly have a populist, and for all the laughter about him, I mean, in a campaign, a guy said, running against him, said, I was raised barefoot. Huey Long said, "Hell, I was born barefoot." But for all that, he was a pretty sinister character, and his Louisiana was as close as we came, really, to a kind of authoritarian state in America. He was, one laughed about him, but the laughter was, in a way, a kind of cover for just how threatening he was to basic democratic institutions like the rule of law.
And for all that, in the case of all these, and we're going to hear a terrific writing on many more, Jack Beatty, I can just feel the attraction in your soul to these stories and the wonderful detail that they're written up in here.
Yeah, I mean, you can't resist these characters, and especially the way these writers treat them. I mean, I've tried to find the best possible writing about these characters, and I think that that paragraph captures it.
Well, that's a good piece of it. We've got much more to come on Warren Harding, on Herbert Hoover, on Sam Rayburn, on Ronald Reagan, Richard Nixon, and more. Stick with us. On this special holiday edition of On Point, we're talking tonight with our very own news analyst, Jack Beatty. He is editor of a new book, Pauls, Great Writers on American Politicians from Bryan to Reagan. We're going to hear a lot more of that. I hope you'll enjoy it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with a special holiday weekend edition of On Point. And I'm joined tonight and so happy to be by our own news analyst who here many evenings on this show. Jack Beattie is with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight, sharing a new book he has out. He's editor of the book called Paul's Great Writers on American Politicians from Bryan to Reagan. And it is a terrific anthology of just mind-bogglingly wonderful writing about the rascals and heroes and otherwise in the long pantheon of American political figures. Jack, there's so much we want to hear here, and I want to just keep plunging ahead because it's so great to hear. You've got H.L. Mencken in here, of course, famously wrote and sharply wrote on many fronts, this time on Warren Harding Bloviator.
Yes, Harding could be terse. A friend of mine once found this love letter from him. I love you clothed, but naked more. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Watch out.
But when he spoke in public, he really spoke in fog. And Mencken really had really memorable sport with his 1921 inaugural address, in which he said sentences like this. This is Harding. I would like government to do all it can to mitigate, then, in understanding, in mutuality of interest, in concern for the common good, our tasks will be solved.
All right, for an long ago.
And Mencken says, well, I don't know about the politics, but then he goes on in his parody, he says, but when it comes to the style of a great man's discourse, I can speak with a great deal less prejudice and maybe with somewhat more competence, for I have earned most of my livelihood for 20 years past by translating the bad English of a multitude of authors into measurably better English. Mm. That was as the editor of the American Mercury magazine. Mm. Thus qualified professionally, I rise to pay my small tribute to Dr. Harding. Setting aside a college professor of 2.5 dozen dipsomaniacal newspaper reporters, he takes the first place in my Valhalla of literati. That is to say, he writes the worst English that I have ever encountered. It reminds me of a string of wet sponges. It reminds me of tattered washing on the line. It reminds me of stale bean soup, of college yells, of dogs barking idiotically through endless nights. It is so bad that a sort of grandeur creeps into it. It drags itself out of the dark abysm, I was about to write abscess, of pish, and crawls insanely up the topmost pinnacle of posh. It is rumble and bumble. It is flap and doodle. It is balder and dash.
And Warren Harding Bloviator must have been silenced by that onslaught. Oh, my gosh. Well, and the title of this piece from H.L. Mencken is, I don't even know how to pronounce it, Jack.
Gamaliz, which was his play on Harding's middle name, Gamal, G-A-M-I-E-L. So this is one of the most famous of Mencken's sallies. He had great sport with Harding. Second, it just slightly outtopped the sport he had with Calvin Coolidge, which you can imagine.
Give us a sense of the politics that were swirling around Mencken and Harding when he wrote this, of Harding's place in that time and moment that might have had Mencken's knife out for him.
Yeah, I mean, Mencken had no more use for Wilson than who was the president before Harding than he did for Harding, but Harding famously coined the phrase, we need a return to normalcy. Mm. And this was after the high idealism, the crusading fervor of the progressive era, and specifically the crusading in foreign relations of Woodrow Wilson, who sought to make the world safe for democracy.
Right.
And with Harding, we were going to have a period of normalcy, not nostrums, he said, normalcy.
Mm. And so Mencken, that wasn't quite enough to please the great Mencken, certainly not the way Harding put it.
Yeah, his objection was as much to the style as to the politics. I think Mencken was a pretty conservative fellow altogether.
Now, when you look at Herbert Hoover, and of course you've got this piece, wonderful piece by Richard Hofstadter here, Herbert Hoover and the Crisis of American Individualism, you entitle this chapter, Herbert Hoover, Our Contemporary. Why so?
Well, because Hoover believed in American individualism. And he believed in, that is, the view that that individuals could make their own way in society, and that society, the social medium, posed no barrier to their rise. He had been pretty much an orphan child, lost his mother at 6 and then his father at 10, raised by by, that was in Iowa, and then moved to Oregon, raised by aunt and uncle there. Scholarship student to Stanford in the first class, who lived in a shack off campus, and then rose to be one of the great engineers in the world, working on continents, gold and mining all over the world. And so he had done this all by himself, and he thought, what I did, everybody can do. And he's our contemporary because after a spell when the American political culture really was more after Franklin Roosevelt, and the emphasis was not on the individual, but on the community, and the emphasis was on the government helping the individual, or someone said, hindering the hindrances that prevent individuals from rising. We're now in a new era, I think, of individualism, when the what seems antique to Richard Hofstadter, writing in the 40s about Herbert Hoover, now makes him seem very much like George Bush.
As FDR's era recedes and Bush's comes to the fore.
Absolutely, absolutely. American individualism is almost the DNA of our political culture. We keep returning to it, and so now.
Let us hold all that in mind. I wish you'd read some selections here from Hofstadter's piece, Herbert Hoover and the Crisis of American Individualism.
Yes, and this really, these two couple of paragraphs really set up the tragedy of Hoover, and people may not know this picture of him. In the autumn of 1919, John Maynard Keynes, out of his disgust and bitterness with the terms of the Versailles Treaty, wrote a devastating book, The Economic Consequences of the Peace. Keynes's judgment of the peacemakers of World War I were severe, but concerning one, Herbert Hoover, he wrote, Mr. Hoover was the only man who emerged from the ordeal of Paris with an enhanced reputation. This complex personality, with his habitual air of weary titan, his eyes tightly fixed on the true and essential facts of the European situation, imported into the councils of Paris, when he took part in them, precisely that atmosphere of reality, knowledge, magnanimity, and disinterestedness, which, if they had been found in other quarters also, would have given us the good peace. Of the work that had been carried out during the first 6 months of that year by the American Relief Administration under Hoover's direction, Keynes wrote, never was a nobler work of disinterested goodwill carried through with more tenacity and sincerity and skill and with less thanks either asked or given. The ungrateful governments of Europe owe much more to the statesmanship and insight of Mr. Hoover and his band of American workers than they have yet appreciated or will ever acknowledge. And then Hofstadter resumes, in a time of havoc and hatred, the name Hoover came to mean food for the starving and medicine for the sick. From the ranks of his co-workers, a fanatic body of admirers had gathered about him. In several European countries, streets were named for him. After 5 years of war service without salary and without attention to his private affairs, his fortune had been somewhat scaled down, but he was rich in popularity. Within little more than a decade, the story of Hoover's wartime career was all but forgotten. The man who had fed Europe had become a symbol of hunger. The brilliant administrator, a symbol of disaster. The Hooverstrassen of the armistice period had given way to the dismal Hoovervilles of the Great Depression, and the great engineer left the White House under as dark a cloud of public disfavor as any president since John Quincy Adams over a century before.
Our own Jack Beatty reading from Richard Hofstadter's piece on Herbert Hoover and the Crisis of American Individualism, just one of the pieces of terrific writing on American political figures in Jack Beatty's new book. He's editor of Paul's Great Writers on American Politicians from Bryan to Reagan. And there, Hoover, Jack, I wonder after spending so much time with all this writing on these figures. And here we have Hoover, who's kind of forever got that stigma that Hofstadter just described there wrapped around him. Even now, when, as you say, Bush may be reviving a Hooverian view of the world, but do politicians get a second chance in death? Are political reputations made once and forever in literature? Is Herbert Hoover always going to be, you know, get the long frown from the American public because he got framed that way in his time and later?
That's such a good question. There for the longest time that was true. I mean, he was just damned, and really up through his lifetime. But since his death in the early 60s, there's been a kind of Herbert Hoover revisionism. And what's happened is that sort of historians who came of age during the Vietnam War went back and sort of began to treasure Hoover's Quaker approach to international affairs. Mm-hmm. He was not an interventionist. He wanted to outlaw war. And so this brought him back into favor. And there were several admiring biographies that focus more on his vision of the world than of his management or failure to manage the domestic economy. So he has been, in a measure, rehabilitated for certain. And by the same token, Woodrow Wilson, who was for long depicted as this, you know, great paladin of American progressivism and savior of the world, he's come in for a kind of a bad press in recent decades from historians.
So the mind keeps, the American mind keeps turning around these figures,
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
You take us on into the world of Sam Rayburn, quite a different era from Hoover. But I wish you'd give us a sense of where Robert Caro takes his look at Sam Rayburn.
Yeah, this is an excerpt from Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson. And Johnson was Rayburn's protege. Rayburn was the House Speaker in the 50s and from the 40s into the 60s with some time out. And he was a short, powerfully built man from a poor part of Texas, and he grew up as a poor boy on the farm. And this passage, these two passages, I think, bring out, well, anyway, I'd like to see the movie of this.
Okay.
He was one of 11 children. His father was a Confederate cavalryman, man stooped from working in the cotton fields. Hmm. And here's the picture that Robert A. Caro draws. Except for 4 months each year in a one-room, one-teacher schoolhouse, Sam Rayburn spent his boyhood in the cotton rows. In the spring, he plowed while he was still so small that his weight couldn't keep the plow point in the ground, and he had to strain to hold it down as the mules yanked it forward. In the summer, under the searing Texas sun, he worked with a hoe, chopping at the plants to thin them out, going to bed at night with an aching back, knowing that at daybreak he would be out with the hoe again. And in September, he would be in the rows on his knees, crawling down the rows, dragging behind him a long sack while he picked the cotton. In the rows, day after day, knees raw and bleeding from the crawling, hands raw and bleeding from the picking, back aching even worse than from the chopping. All through his boyhood, Sam's life was the cotton fields, the fields and little else. If, Sunday, chores were light, they were supposed to be replaced not by play, but by piety. Many a time when I was a child and lived way out in the country, Sam Rayburn later recalled, I'd sit on the fence and wish to God that somebody would ride by on a horse or drive by in a buggy, just anybody, to relieve my loneliness. Terrible as were the toil and the poverty, the loneliness was worse. Poverty, he was to say, only tries men's souls. It is loneliness that breaks the heart. Loneliness consumes people. In the bleakness and boredom of Sam Rayburn's childhood, there stood out a single vivid day. Fannin County's congressman was Joseph Weldon Bailey, who as minority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives dominated the Democratic minority like an overseer and conducted himself like a conqueror, and was expected, if the Democrats won control of Congress, to become Speaker. Bailey was one of the greatest of the great populist orators. When he spoke in the House, it was said, his tones lingered in the chamber like the echo of chimes in a cathedral. In 1894, when Sam Rayburn was 12, Bailey spoke in Bonham, the county seat, and Sam Rayburn heard him. He was to remember all his life, every detail of that day, how it was raining so heavily that his mule took hours to cover the 11 miles to town, how he felt when he arrived at the covered tent tabernacle of the Bonham Evangelical Church where Bailey was speaking. I didn't go into that tabernacle. I'd never been to Bonham since we bought the farm, and I was scared of all the rich town folks in their store-bought clothes. But I found a flap in the canvas, and I stuck there like glue while old Joe Bailey made his speech. Passing the barn the next morning, his brothers heard a voice inside. Looking through the door, they saw their little brother standing on a feeding trough practicing a political speech. From that day, from the day he heard Joe Bailey, Sam Rayburn knew where he was going to go. And in 1900, when he was 18, Sam, standing in a field with his father one day, told him he wanted to go to college. His father said that he had no money to send him. "I'm not asking for you to send me, Pa," Sam said. "I'm asking you to let me go." The cavalryman's back was stooped from the fields now. He was old. Two of his eight sons had already left the farm. The loss of a third pair of strong hands would be hard to bear. "You have my blessing," he said. On the day Sam left, his clothes rolled up and tied with a rope because he had no suitcase, his father hitched up the buggy and drove him to the railroad station. A silent man, he stood there silently until the train arrived and his son was about to board it. Then he suddenly reached out and pressed some bills into his son's hand. $25. Sam never forgot that. He talked about that $25 for the rest of his life. "God knows how he saved it," he would say. "He never had any extra money. We earned just enough to live. It broke me up, him handing me that $25. I often wondered what he did without, what sacrifice he and my mother made." And he never forgot the four words his father said to him as he climbed aboard the train. He was to tell friends that he had remembered them at every crisis in his life. Clutching his son's hand, his father said, "Sam, be a man."
Jack Beatty, reading from Robert Caro's writing on Sam Rayburn, just one of the pieces in Jack's new anthology, Paul's Great Writers on American Politicians from Bryan to Reagan. Jack, that story, and as you read it, I can see the Hollywood movie that you'd like to see made of it. That describes a life migration that not many American politicians make today, from hands and knees, scraped knees, hard work all day in the cotton field, to the halls of power that Sam Rayburn so dominated.
Isn't that true? I mean, when Paul Wellstone was elected to the Senate from Minnesota, the late Paul Wellstone, he joked that he was the only man in the body who got a raise on taking the job.
So many millionaires doing it as a second career, almost a second thought.
That's right. That's right. And people like Sam Rayburn, no, you don't find many of them. You find more of them among African American politicians, people like Charlie Rangel, who came up the hard way. But it's harder and harder to find them.
But admiration here also for Robert Caro, who could reach out and so empathetically feel that youth that Sam Rayburn had before heading east on the train.
Oh, absolutely. And to Caro's admirers, of course, to his critics, he extends darn little of that toward Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah. Well, LBJ's a big guy. He can deal with it. We're talking tonight with our own Jack Beatty. His new book is Paul's Great Writers on American Politicians from Bryan to Reagan. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, with a special holiday weekend edition, I'm joined by our own Jack Beatty, who is out with a wonderful new book, Paul's Great Writers on American Politicians from Bryan to Reagan, the Boodlers, Demagogues, Heroes, Jokesters, Populists, and Thinkers. Jack Beatty has scoured the worlds of great political writing, or writing about great politicians, and brought us a tremendous buffet here. We've been hearing a lot of it, and we'll hear more tonight. Jack, there's a couple we won't get to read from, but I wish you'd just give us a sense of. Many of our listeners may have read some of David McCullough on Harry Truman, but you've got a segment here called Harry Truman Grit, drawing on McCullough's writing. Give us a glimpse of that.
Well, this is an excerpt from David McCullough's wonderful chapter on the Whistle Stop Campaign of 1948, when Harry Truman, fighting impossible odds, a poll of 50 journalists on his train had 50 of them predicting he would lose. His mother-in-law thought he would lose. No one thought he could win. And yet he went out to the people. And he connected with them, and McCullough shows it happening, shows him speaking to Iowa audiences. And, of course, Iowa was a thoroughly Republican state, mm-hmm. and charming them with stories about how how he learned to plow, and how his father said, you know, I like that. You don't leave skip places when you plow. Mm-hmm. And I'm very proud of that. And the audience would just smile and laugh and be charmed. And through that sort of thing, and also a relentless attack on the Republicans, he won. He won going away. And, of course, the Gallup poll predicted the opposite, and someone quipped, he's the only man in presidential history to lose in a Gallup and win in a walk.
The haberdasher, not really a plowman, but it worked well enough in Iowa. And then there's this great look at John F. Kennedy by Norman Mailer, the existential hero, where you say this is Mailer observing JFK at the 1960 Democratic Convention, and in that literary observation as opposed to journalistic, you see much of the 60s sort of foretold.
Well, yeah, he treats, this is a piece about Kennedy's coming to the convention at Los Angeles that nominated him, and Mailer, writing this piece for Esquire magazine, really sees Kennedy as a culture hero, as somebody who's going to awaken the American unconscious, the sort of the dream life of America from its 50s sleep, and take the country in a bold and dangerous, potentially dangerous course. And, of course, he's so right about that. And as he sees Kennedy getting out of the limousine, and he just looks how he looks, how his appearance and so on, he said, and suddenly I saw the convention. It came into focus for me, and I understood the mood of depression which had lain over the convention, because finally it was simple. The Democrats were going to nominate a man who, no matter how serious his political dedication might be, was indisputably and willy-nilly going to be seen as a great box office actor. Mm-hmm. And the consequences of that were staggering and not at all easy to calculate.
But you've got this moment where Norman Mailer pictures the dark forces in the American imagination running around and behind this moment, this time. He says, the subterranean river of untapped, ferocious, lonely, and romantic desires, that concentration of ecstasy and violence, which is the dream life of the nation, all that river waiting to go where in 1960?
Waiting to sort of break upon the culture of Mamie Eisenhower. Mm. and you know, in effect here, he's talking about the energies, for good and ill, of the 60s that really transformed the culture. And one way of looking at that is to say that, in some sense, the unconscious of the culture was acted out by people, sort of acted out in the streets.
Out with the prim 50s, in with the 60s. There's a section here from Lou Cannon on Ronald Reagan. And, of course, Lou Cannon has paid a lot of attention to Ronald Reagan, and a bit different in the way he's focusing here on Ronald Reagan's very, almost ingenious use of humor.
Yes, Reagan called it kidding on the square, that it was a way of kidding but also making a point and using humor. And his most frequent target was himself, and I quote from Lou Cannon, no president since Lincoln was as self-effacing, and no president in the history of the Republic was as effective at self-ridicule. In public and in private, Reagan regularly poked fun at his age, his work habits, his movies, his ideology, his vanities, his memory lapses, his supposed domination by his wife, and even the widely held view that he was unintelligent. Reagan was aware that many of his critics thought him a modest man with much to be modest about. But he also realized that he could upstage his adversaries by beating them to the punch. When he was informed during the 1980 campaign that some of his opponents intended to make a point of his age by sending him greetings on his 69th birthday, Reagan started using Jack Benny jokes about his birthday, which he called the 30th anniversary of his 39th birthday. This tactic diffused the age issue so effectively that such jokes became a permanent part of the Reagan repertoire, sometimes combined with references to other presumed disabilities. You know, that brings me to a story. Almost everything does. Maybe I've told the story to you before, but then you'll just have to hear it again, because life not only begins at 40, but so does lumbago and the tendency to tell the same story over and over again. Reagan could do this because he was personally secure enough to make himself the butt of his humor. He once explained to me in some detail how his friend Jack Benny had used self-ridicule as the foundation of his comedy, emphasizing that it was Benny's self-security that made his art possible. In Reagan's view, this freed him to portray a character, stingy, self-centered, that was the opposite of the real Jack Benny. Reagan most often played himself, but it seemed to me that he was saying something about himself as well as Benny. Reagan could poke fun at his ignorance because he considered himself abundantly blessed with common sense. He could laugh at himself because he knew he had a serious purpose. He was not afraid to say what came into his head. When a wire service reporter asked him to autograph an old studio picture showing Reagan with the chimpanzee Bonzo, he happily obliged. The inscription read, "I'm the one with the watch."
The humor would not go away, and it worked again and again. Jack, I'm tempted to ask you throughout all this whether you see, I mean, these are the biggest figures in American politics. These are many of them presidents and other very, very powerful politicians. Do you end up seeing them or seeing them through the writing that you've collected here as shaping American culture or as products of American culture? Of course, we know they're both, but where's the balance?
Yes. Was it Emerson who said the great secret of the universe is the connection between man and event? And in some of these men, you can see the culture acting through them, certainly in Herbert Hoover, who summed up the 19th century individualism. But in others, in Kennedy, and I think to a certain extent in Reagan, you can see people changing the culture, certainly Reagan was a historic president because he changed the political culture. After the Reagan years, people thought differently about what it was government should or should not do. After all, in the Reagan wake, Bill Clinton said, "The era of big government is over." No Democrat before Reagan would say that.
And what about in the writers themselves over time and the way they look at political figures? You reach pretty far back here to H.L. Mencken and John Dos Passos, and then very contemporary with Richard Ben Kramer and others much more recent. Do you see an arc of evolution in the way they consider these political figures?
I think that there is more, at least in the stronger writing, there is more, what should one say, vitriol. In the case of the portrait of George Herbert Walker Bush by Richard Ben Kramer, to which you allude, the vitriol is sort of parceled out in a narrative style, but it's there nevertheless. And you see how George Herbert Walker Bush decided to take the low road against Michael Dukakis to win. And the writer is admiring of what it takes to win. That's the name of his book, What It Takes. And at the same time, kind of regretful that this is what it takes to win.
Then you go to Philip Roth and his writing on Richard Nixon. Tricky is the operative word here.
Yes, this is a great satire. This is probably one of the great political satires in American writing. It's called from a book called Our Gang that Philip Roth, as he puts it, was, I think, ignited to write after Richard Nixon, the weekend he invaded Cambodia, came out and said that from personal and religious beliefs, I consider abortions an unacceptable form of population control. I am for the sanctity of life. This is while he was invading Cambodia. So then Roth imagines a press conference where Richard Nixon has a back and forth with reporters about this statement that he made in Sam Clemente about the value of life. And it dawns on Nixon in the middle of this press conference and on the reporters that Nixon has the notion of enfranchising the fetus. That he's out to
voters.
New voters there. So let's do a little of this press conference.
All right, you've assigned me a role here. I'll read it. We're in the press conference. Richard Nixon, indicated as tricky here by Philip Roth, gets a question from Mr., shall we say, obsequious.
Yes.
"Sir, as regards your San Dementia statement of April 3rd, the discussion it provoked seemed to now have centered on your unequivocal declaration that you are a firm believer in the rights of the unborn. Many seem to believe that you are destined to be the unborn, to the unborn, what Martin Luther King was to the black people of America, and the late Robert F. Charisma to the disadvantaged Chicanos and Puerto Ricans of the country. There are those who say that your San Dementia statement will go down in history books alongside Dr. King's famous I Have a Dream address. Do you find these comparisons apt?"
Well, of course, Mr. Obsequious. Martin Luther King was a very great man, as we all must surely recognize now that he is dead. He was a great leader in the struggle for equal rights for his people. And yes, I do believe he'll find a place in history. But of course, we must not forget that he was not the President of the United States, as I am, empowered by the Constitution, as I am. And this is an important distinction to bear in mind. Working within the Constitution, I think I will be able to accomplish far more for the unborn of this entire nation than did Dr. King working outside the Constitution for the born of a single race. This is meant to be no criticism of Dr. King, just a simple statement of fact. You know, we all watch our TV and we see the demonstrators and we see the violence because, unfortunately, that is the kind of thing that makes the news. But how many of us realize that throughout this great land of ours, there were millions upon millions of embryos going through the most complex and difficult changes in form and structure, and all this they accomplished without waving signs for the camera and disrupting traffic and throwing paint and using foul language and dressing in outlandish clothes. Yes, Mr. Darren.
But what about those fetuses, sir, that the vice president has labeled troublemakers? I believe he was referring specifically to those who start in kicking around the fifth month. Do you agree that they are malcontents and ingrates? And if so, what measures do you intend to take to control them?
Well, first off, Mr. Daring, I believe we are dealing here with some very fine distinctions of a legal kind. Now, fortunately, impish, endearing smile, I happen to be a lawyer and have the kind of training that enables me to make these fine distinctions. I think we have to be very careful here, and I am sure the Vice President would agree with me, to distinguish between two kinds of activity, kicking in the womb, to which the Vice President was specifically referring, and moving in the womb. You see, the Vice President did not say, despite what you may have heard on television, that all fetuses who are active in the womb are troublemakers. Nobody in this administration believes that. In fact, I have just today spoken with both Attorney General Malicious and Mr. Heehaw at the FBI, and we are all in agreement that a certain amount of movement in the womb after the fifth month is not only inevitable, but desirable in a normal pregnancy. But as for this other matter, I assure you this administration does not intend to sit idly by and do nothing while American women are being kicked in the stomach by a bunch of violent five-month-olds. Now, by and large, and I cannot emphasize this enough, our American unborn are as wonderful a group of unborn as you could find anywhere. But there are these violent few that the Vice President has characterized, and I don't think unjustly, in his own impassioned rhetoric as troublemakers and malcontents, and the Attorney General has been instructed by me to take the appropriate action against them.
And so Richard Nixon is scorched by Philip Roth in Tricky Comforts a Troubled Citizen. Jack, we've just got a minute left here, but I'm tempted to think in all this about the balance between political figures and the people who write about them, the kind of balance of energy, the balance of perspective, the way that these writers are, in a funny way, even years later, an answer to political perspectives or a break on political directions that may, you know, lean far in one way or another. There's a dance here that's important.
Oh, there is. And the stance of the writer is so important. I mean, Richard Nixon's achievements and failures are well known. But what was really significant here was that really one of our greatest writers was inspired to write a piece of satire that will last as long, I think, as Nixon lasts, precisely out of the depth of his animosity toward Richard Nixon.
We are just about out of time. Let's go out with a few words again from Vachel Lindsay and Brian. He's talking about prairie schooner children born beneath the stars, beneath falling snows, with the babies born at midnight in the sod huts of lost hope, with no physician there except a Kansas prayer, with the Indian raid a howling through the air, as good as anything for Thanksgiving weekend, Jack. Thanks so much for sharing all this with us tonight.
Well, thank you very much for letting me do it.
Jack Beatty, our own dear news analyst and editor of the new book, Paul's Great Writers on American Politicians, from Bryan to Reagan, the Boodlers, Demagogues, Heroes, Jokesters, Populists, and Thinkers. Have a great holiday weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.